Blog Talk Radio.
Blog Talk Radio, lady, is a little slow tonight.
Well, very slow.
All right. This is Rabble Rousing Rich Bergeron.
Yeah, and with all respect to the weather going on right now, this is a tornado, Tony Pennycal.
Exactly. Well, it didn't. It was over Chicago last night, and it didn't prevent the game there. Of course, it was indoors. So, but triple overtime. Bruins are down 1-0 on a miraculous shot.
I watched part of the third period, then I watched the first overtime, and I had to go to bed because I had an early morning wake up call to go to the gym and slap some people around.
Yeah, I'm not worried about him though. That was the first time they were ever even down a goal in a long time in this playoffs.
Well, you figure you got it, and this is not anything against the Bruins. This is more of a slap against the Penguins, who I hate. The Blackhawks managed two more goals and one more win than Pittsburgh did in four games.
Right, that's incredible.
Yeah.
And the Penguins scored the most goals of any NHL team in the regular season, so no figure.
Yeah, well, that's the thing. Here's the problem. The Penguins are a team with a lot of skill, a lot of flash, but when you have a guy like Crosby, he's a front runner. And there's always certain fighters I talk about, and I call them front runners. And recently, Zab Judah proved me wrong on that because he came back from fault when he was hurt pretty good. But certain fighters, and I would say him as my ultimate example, when things are growing great, they're great. When things get a little tough, they tend to fold. So what Boston did is, and they did it perfectly in that series, is they employed a very tough defense, a very physical defense. They walked Crosby and the gang up a little bit, and they got Crosby up in the game. When Crosby, who I would bet against in a fight against probably a kindergartner, he's starting to challenge a guy like Chara, you're in his head. Now, Rich, I didn't watch all the games, I only saw bits and pieces, but a friend of mine texted me and told me at one point that when Crosby was mapping off to Chara, which is a joke amongst itself, the Char got down on his knees and challenged him to fight.
I didn't see that one.
I didn't see him, but it's hilarious.
But I noticed that the Penguins were really trying to get under the skin of the Bruins and trying to initiate a lot of fights and throwing a lot of cheap shots. And last night's game shows you what happens when two teams who really respect each other get on the ice against each other, because those guys, I think there was like two penalties, and none of them looked like they were intentional. One was like a really cheap tripping penalty, even though, it was against the Blackhawks. It was like the guy just basically put his stick down by Chara's skate there, and that was a call of the penalty for tripping. It wasn't really that bad, and that was like the worst penalty of the whole night. The rest of them were mostly too many men on the ice penalties, so, and there were no fights whatsoever. There's a couple like high sticks, but
when I was talking to my friend last week, and she hates the Penguins. I mean, she despises the Penguins. So, of course, she's all excited when, they got manhandled in that series. And at one point, she was like, Crosby and his bunch of pansies. And she was using a lot stronger language than that. They're really showing the NHL and all the fans what they're really made of. And now people are on to their act now. And I stopped and I said, Jackie, wait a minute. I said, we saw what they were made of last year when they played the Flyers in the opening round, and the Flyers upset them, which was a pretty big upset. And one point, like Crosby answered, like the Penguins like won like game four when they were hurt death 3-0, and he's sitting there and he cheap shot at somebody, and he goes, "We just don't like them." He sounded like a little school kid that was like always the one that would start fights and run to the teacher. And then when finally he wasn't getting his way, we're like, "Well, we don't like that. Like, I don't care what you people say, because we just don't like them. Like, you just sound like a crybaby already." But she came back with a good one. She was, "Well, the Flyers have never been a highly respected team ever since their runs in the 70s when they were the Broad Street Bullies. But now that that's happened against a team that's a little bit more favorably like Boston, then that's really shining a negative light on Crosby and his bunch of whiners.
Well, for those of you who didn't know, hockey was a combat sport.
Well, it is, actually.
It's kind of an honorary combat sport. But let's move on. We got Psychic Tom with us now. He redeemed himself, actually, the last 2 weeks predicting, or last two UFC cards predicting the main event there. And
I can't hear you. I can't hear you, Rich. The crowd's cheering too loud. I'm still going to take my bows.
Well, Tom, did you hear what I said about you when we were first getting on the air?
No, I missed the first minute or two.
Okay, well, your psychic abilities are going to be tested. After the fights are over on Saturday, and I drag you upstairs to the roulette table.
Okay.
I want five or six straight numbers, like, dude, 14. 14, all right. I'll put like 10 bucks on, get 35 to 1 odds. Yeah, that'll work.
He's going to be the Ray Babbitt to Tony's Tom Cruise, I guess.
Okay, okay. We'll look forward to it.
Tony's supposed to be the Rain Man, though, so I don't know how that's going to work.
we'll find out.
Well, anyway.
Tom, I did get your email today. I was on the road, and I went and met with my one friend for lunch because he got rained out of work today. To answer your question, it's Greek. It's wearing traditional Greek garb, so we're all going in togas.
Okay. See, Rich, to fill you in on this, you know, see, I always want to make sure I'm dressed appropriately. You know, I mean, if I'm in the press section, I'm fairly, you know, fairly businesslike, and then other times I just feel like I'll be super casual. But I want to fit in. So togas, okay. Cool. All right. So that's why I was asking Tony. I said, let me fit in here. Give me the inside stuff. I hate to sound silly about it.
But it pays to ask. Yeah. So basically what I'm going to wear is I'm going to wear black jeans, like black sneakers, just like regular like T-shirt and stuff like that. And then usually when I go to the fights anymore, what I do kind of like, be like a poor man's burnt sugar. I always bring like my black fedora with me.
In this Captain America outfit.
My Phillies outfit has finally been named. It hasn't helped them win, but I finally named it. You look like Uncle Sam. You look like Apollo Creed. it's now called my Uncle Creed outfit.
There you go. There you go.
The one I was watching for the UFC events lately, it was on ESPN from the UK, and they call it ESPN America over there. And they had a commercial for it, and it was like for ESPN America for your mobile phone or whatever. And it was about a guy who was like blowing off his wife calling his phone, and he had all his buddies over watching something at the house, or some kind of sports on ESPN America. And they're all partying, and one guy looks just like Tony in his America outfit there with the hat and everything. And he actually looked cute, too. He had, like, same color hair, the goatee, everything. So I was like, wow, that's funny. If I could only have taped it, but it's on the Internet. It's kind of tough. But anyway, we got a lot of boxing MMA news to cover here. We got some stuff going on with 50 Cent down there in Hartford. He had a big press conference yesterday. He's going to have a pretty huge first card down there for Friday Night Fights with Elider Alvarez taking on Alan Green in the main event. And a buddy of one of our former guests, Mike Oliver, a guy who used to actually train. Iceman John Scully used to train him, I believe. I met him a couple times. He's also on the card. I don't see right in front of me who he's facing, but I have it somewhere. Oh, here it is. I've got to go to the actual press release. Mike Machine Gun Oliver, he's 25-3 with 8 knockouts. He's fighting Billy Dibb, who's 35-2 with 21 knockouts. And Dibb actually had a pretty competitive fight on March 1st, also on ESPN Friday Night Fights, where he lost a 12-round split decision.
That was a good fight. What's funny was, I think that was a show that 50 put on, and I remember Teddy Atlas was very concerned that Dibb being, basically, quote unquote, the hometown boy there, and he clearly lost that fight. They were worried that he was going to get unfairly rewarded, and Teddy was very pleased when the judges awarded it to the right fighter.
Yeah. Also on the card, Mark Davis is undefeated at 16-0 with 5 knockouts at lightweight. He's going to be fighting Danish Robert Osobi, who's 14-5-4 with 6 knockouts. And undefeated Puerto Rican welterweight Javier El Chino Flores, who's 9-0 with 8 knockouts, will be fighting Rogelio De La Torre, who's 10-3 with 6 knockouts. That about does it for the main fights there. But it should be a pretty big show for 50 Cent. Also his birthday, though it doesn't say how old he is, or he will be on July 5th down there in Hartford. It's going to be his first solo boxing promotion, by the way. So I guess he's co-promoted before, but we'll see how that goes. And what about the fights over the weekend?
Oh, well, we had a couple really good cards over the weekend. In fact, my friends wanted me to go to Tilt to Kilt with them. They were going to watch the UFC fights. But I was like, guys, I said, I got two really good boxing cards on. And the one guy going with you is the guy that I have some bad blood with right now. So I was like, the most competitive of the fight is going to be me twisting this guy's head off. So I said, I think it's best if I stay in and watch the actual boxing matches. I'll be in a much better mood. So we had Carlos Patera and Shaka on HBO. We'll do the HBO card first, which I have to say was less impressive of the two. On paper, maybe the more impressive of the two, but results-wise, less impressive. First fight was Yuriyoko Gamboa against Dalys Perez. Fight wasn't that good. It was really cautious. Gamboa didn't look great. It ended up being, a decision win. And the main event was the shocker of the night. It was Adonis Stevenson laying out bad Chad Dawson with one punch about 70 seconds into the first round. And a bunch of us came to the same conclusion right after the fight was over. How was Dawson going to blame this one on John Scully? Then we go to the Showtime card, which was really the bread and butter. The first fight, Jermall Charlo, a fresh win over who we're going to see this weekend, Harry Yorgi. He stepped up to fight Demetrius Hopkins, the nephew of Bernard the Executioner. And Demetrius is a very, very cautious fighter. And the guys, they never got into a rhythm. It ended up just being not a lot of action in the fight. Charlo won a decision. But the next fight was the one that was worth all the money in the world, and that was Arisandri Lara versus Alfredo Angulo. That was the one my dad was looking forward to. And last week, I predicted Lara being the better boxer to, catch Angulo on the way in and then finally be able to either outmaneuver him, do a decision, or maybe stop him late. Well, for the most part, Lara was able to box him from a distance, landed some good southpaw left hands, but Angulo would get him on the ropes and he would just pound the body. I mean, he was hitting some body shots I could feel, turning into him. I mean, they were hard, and you could see he was hurting Lara. And then a couple times, I think it was in like the fourth round, and I forget, was it the eighth or ninth, I don't remember offhand, he threw that left foot to the head and caught Lara and put him down hard. And Lara got up, and kept fighting on. He was hurt. And then finally, Angulo's face was really starting to bust up a lot. And Laura landed a right hand, they said it might have broken the orbital socket, but Pengula was turned around, and within seconds, it looked like he had a grapefruit over his left eye that stopped the fight. But hey, what the hell, what a battle. Possible fight of the year right there. And then the main event, which was another war, Josecito Lopez and Marcos Maidana. Maidana moving up in weight, Lopez coming off that five-round loss to Canelo Alvarez. And, I mean, they were going at it. And Lopez had him hurt a couple times, Maidana obviously being a favorite. And then and finally Maidana was able to hurt him with a good body shot in the sixth round, and then he caught him with a shot to the head, put Lopez down, and then his follow-up flurry prompted the stoppage. Good stoppage, very necessary.
Well, another boxing news here. I got some story about Friday's fights. Actually, there's some major controversy, the Friday Showbox card. I don't know if you heard anything about this, Tony, but I was kind of surprised about this myself. We've heard of referees ruining fights before. Probably the last one I can remember off the top of my head was how the Mayweather versus Ortiz fight there, where the referee didn't seem to be looking at what was happening there, even though it was technically, you know, one of those things where you always got to keep your hands up. But anyway, this time it was a fight between middleweight Jorge Melendez and Nick Brinson. Nick Brinson and Melendez. And Nick Brinson apparently won the fight by decision, I believe. But what happened was they're filing a protest with the Oneida Indian Nation Athletic Commission because referee Charlie Fitch apparently didn't read the rules. He thought there was a standing eight count in this fight, and that was not in the rules for this fight. So they say the careful review of the fight will show that Melendez should be awarded a TKO victory because late in the fourth round, Melendez landed a counter left that sent Brinson into the ropes, clearly out on his feet. Brinson made a motion to sit on the ropes, and for the referee had ruled a knockdown at that point, it would have been a proper ruling. However, a full 7 seconds later, with Brinson stumbling senselessly sideways toward his own corner, Fitch then halted the action and issued a standing eight count, which lasted another 11 to 14 seconds by the showtime clock. And according to these representatives of Melendez, they said the unified rules of the Association of Boxing Commissions were in effect. So there's no standing eight count. So when referee Fitch gave Nick Brinson a standing eight count, he was in violation of rule number 7. The ropes were not holding Brinson up at the time he started the count, and so his only justified options were to either allow the fight to continue or rule a TKO. By jumping in and issuing the illegal count, he improperly allowed Brinson time to recover that he was not allowed under the rules. And so that action apparently changed the outcome, and they're claiming that their fighter should have a TKO victory. Or change the fight to a no contest, which is probably the more likely ruling if they do change the decision. But Team Melendez agrees that Fitch doesn't seem to have any improper motives for his actions. It's just a professional mistake, I guess. They're saying that their fighter has a world rating to protect. He did what he had to do against the guy who fought well. He put his opponent out, and only the referee's mistake stopped that from happening. So we'll see what happens there. I don't think I've ever seen that where standing eight count was given when it wasn't supposed to be.
Yeah, you just have to go back to the what is the criteria to referee a fight? You got to wonder. I mean, sometimes you can make mistakes in judgment, but that's off the charts. I mean, a standing eight count's either allowed or it isn't.
Yeah, I've heard of, like, long counts and stuff like that that have been challenged, but, you know, it's a few seconds here or there. This is like 30 seconds they gave this guy to recover between, you know, the initial sitting on the ropes there and stopping the action to do the standing eight count, so... And then to have the guy come back and win the fight. It's pretty ridiculous, but what can you do?
We have to assume the referee was not the promoter's brother-in-law, right?
I don't think so. Either way, there's got to be a better way to challenge fights. Some kind of instant replay or something, where as soon as something like that happens, it can be remedied, number one. And number two, if after the fact they realize that this was a big mistake, like maybe somebody didn't have the rule book right in front of them at the time, didn't know that they were standing, and kind of wasn't in a, found out later. If that's the case, and it's not something they could fix right away, then they should fix it afterwards. But the very least, they should have some kind of clause that's, regardless of contract, if something like this happens in a fight, there's an immediate rematch, something, so these guys can get another fair shot at him. But getting over to MMA, big news announced today, Alexander Gustafsson is going to get the next shot at the UFC light heavyweight champion, John Jones. It's going to happen at UFC 165 this fall. Jones is apparently doing all right with his recovery, but he's not going to be available till October for his toe situation. So looks like UFC 165 is going to be September 21st, actually. So actually, it'll be ready at the end of September. And it's going to be in Toronto at the Air Canada Center. And I don't know if foot stomps are still legal, but maybe that'll be rough up that toe. Hit him in the toe! I never hear that in a fight. Anyway, the injury happened at UFC 159 in his bout against Chael Sonnen. And October was said to be a more realistic date for his return a few days ago when they were still talking about this fight and they hadn't signed it, but apparently he's going to be back a little bit earlier than that. And both of these guys have been actually kind of lobbying for this fight, so it's not really a surprise. But we'll see. This is probably one of the better opponents as far as young guns and talented guys that are on the rise here for Jones to fight, so we'll see what happens. But one of the things that have been bandied about is that this could be his last title defense at 205 for a little while, because there's super fights being discussed, but him and Anderson Silva, there's potential for him to move up to heavyweight instead of Cormier coming down to light heavyweight for that fight. So there's all kinds of possibilities there. We'll see what happens there, but I definitely think Jones might stay put. The only reason that he's even talking about moving up or down is, I guess, because if he beats Gustafsson, that will be the record. He'll set the record for most consecutive title defenses. Another issue making news lately is a couple points on the testosterone replacement therapy fight, storyline there. California has apparently made it illegal for now. No exemptions are going to be given to new folks, I guess, but apparently if somebody has gotten it before, they can still petition for it. But as far as new people asking for that, the California State Athletic Commission has said no, they're not going to allow any new people to apply for it, which could cause a lot of issues for the UFC, since they have so many guys that are admitted users. And Vitor Belfort actually was in the news after his last fight in Brazil against Luke Rockhold for telling the crowd to beat up a reporter who even asked about TRT. And now he actually sat down with that same reporter and agreed to talk about it. He has some interesting perspectives and thoughts on it. Stuff that I've actually not really heard much before from these different guys. Usually they kind of shake it off, or they just point to having some kind of issue where they need it. But nobody's been this articulate about it. So let me just get straight to his quotes. Belfort told this reporter, "So basically what TRT is for me is not to be at a disadvantage. people talk like it's a cheating process, but it's the opposite. Low testosterone is something that can cause serious health problems and even death. You can have problems, big problems, if it's untreated. So the treatment is for you to live longer and have a better life by having less health problems. Also said, people think TRT is about increased sex drive or performance enhancement. It's not that. It's about life. It's like women and progesterone. They don't get pregnant if they don't have any progesterone, so they need to replace that hormone. It's similar with TRT. It's just for me to have a better health, a better life, apparently to become pregnant. No. both the Rockhold and Bisping fights, Belfort's levels were all deemed acceptable, but the phenom said he took things one step further and conducted additional tests at his own expense. So this is a new angle we've never heard. He actually paid out of his own pocket to test himself, I think, once a week. Yeah, once every week, he said. 7 blood tests he did for the Rockhold fight. And he says he has records of all of them. Some of the results were actually even lower than they should be, he said. And the doctor said, you should probably increase. And I said, no, I don't want to get to a level that's bad for me. I just want people to know that I have a conscience, and I wanted to have something, a record, that for the rest of my life, people can know I was doing something right. I don't ever want to cheat. He says, I have the receipts, too. Sometimes the blood work costs over $1,000. Dealing with hormones is something you don't control. It's inside you. I wish I could not be doing this. Waking up and putting a needle in your arm. I don't like it. It's annoying to me. But it's become part of my system, just like someone treating diabetes or some other condition. I don't like it, but this is something I have to do for treatment, and I'm not ashamed. Everything is legal, and I want people to know what it is. Everybody talks, but nobody really knows. Sometimes we have a tendency to judge or criticize. Most people who do that, maybe they just don't know. I hope just explaining everything can let people know. I had low testosterone, and it was making me feel tired and lethargic. I visited with my doctors, and they recommended TRT for me. Also, I forget which card it was, but Brian Bowles just tested with astronomically high TRT levels. It's like 17 to 1 or something like that. He just got busted on. And he lost in that fight. So it's just another cautionary tale of don't abuse these drugs. But it brought up kind of an interesting side of that whole issue, too, because the main reason a lot of folks who don't get exemptions are using TRT is to come back from injuries. And he's a young guy, so I've got no other excuse to use it. And he was coming back from an injury. So this is where you see a lot of the undocumented usage of this stuff. And this is where you hear a lot of guys say, you guys don't even know in the media how much this stuff is being used.
Now, Rich, let me ask you something. In your studies of this, do you feel that most of the fighters on this are doing it under medical supervision with actual injections as opposed to, say, the supplements you can find in the bodybuilding magazines? What do you think?
I don't know. That's an interesting side of it that I haven't read anything about, how people are using it. But, I kind of laugh sometimes when I see these commercials for this stuff, like Ageless Male and, the stuff you can get in a bottle and you don't have to get from a doctor. And I would think that that has to be abused by these guys because it's so simple. You don't have to inject yourself. A lot of people are afraid of needles and stuff like that, and it's just kind of that association with, you're sticking a needle in yourself, you're definitely cheating, but if you pop a pill, it's like not a
big deal. Exactly, and there's, if you go through a lot of the common bodybuilding magazines, there's everything in there from testosterone cream or testosterone powder, where you just mix it into a fruit drink, or the pills. And it's all the herbal elements that are designed to supposedly boost testosterone. So I'm just wondering if you had a feel for that, if most of these guys are going to get injections all the time, or if any of them are doing it with this stuff over the counter, and if they're testing positive with that. I find that interesting.
Doing exemptions are going through their doctors because they have to. They have to get evidence that they need it, so they have to go through it. But the guys that are doing it underground without any kind of oversight, they're probably using both ways. And whether they're going through a doctor or not to do it, they're keeping it quiet. because they're not testing, you know, most people aren't, that are doing it aren't testing for it when the fight comes up, because the number one concern of a lot of these guys who aren't doing it and are pissed as people are under the radar and not getting tested for it is because they're using it in training. And obviously if you train harder for a fight, weeks out from the fight, you stop doing the testosterone, it's not going to give you a boost for the actual fight, but you know, the training that led up to it, you've bulked up, maybe you got more muscles, you're stronger. So going into the fight, you still get the effects of the TRT, but you're just not getting that immediate effect.
Right, right. Yeah, exactly. That's a very good point, because a lot of top bodybuilders feel that the steroid advantage, a lot of the steroid advantage is the recovery factor, that you can go in the gym and train so much harder and recover so much quicker and be back in the next day doing the same thing for a different body part. Whereas doing it naturally, you've got to take more time off.
And what's kind of interesting to me, I was thinking this week, is, you know, it seems like you hear so much more about this in MMA, even though you've had a few boxers recently test positive
mm-hmm.
for testosterone when they shouldn't have been doing it. And you don't hear of exemptions being given to boxers. Unless I haven't seen these articles or something. I don't know. Have you heard anything, Tony, about boxers getting testosterone use exemptions? Tony, we lose him? No wonder it's been so quiet.
Oh.
Get him back. So, yeah. I thought that was weird that... you know, you see it so much in mixed martial arts, and granted, there's a lot more involved with, you know.
Tornado.
Hey, Tony. I was just trying to go to you, and you weren't there.
You said you were going to ask me something, I wasn't there?
Yeah. What happened there?
What was that asking?
We were talking about testosterone replacement therapy and why we haven't seen it become as much of a story in boxing as it is in MMA. And I was wondering if you've heard anything about boxers getting approved for testosterone use exemptions from these commissions.
I have not, actually. In fact, the latest I heard from you guys, I thought we got, because I got a call failed. That was shortly after we were discussing the bad refereeing.
I was wondering why you jumped all over that.
Yeah, and then I lost you, and then... And then I don't know if you were having problems with your computer or whatever. I know you said you had some issues. But no, what we wrote was testosterone replacement. No, I have not heard a lot about that in the boxing world. Not to say that there's not stuff like behind the scenes or working with the commissions, but I personally have not, you know, really heard anything about it. Mainly in the boxing world, you know, I hear the majority... would be stuff on like weight loss supplements, and then, you know, obviously some steroids the guys have gotten caught with. You guys like Shane Mosley, Fernando Vargas, James Toney, and a few others. Some of the ones that the guys got caught with were stuff to recover from injuries. They happened to fall on the banned list, but no, nothing with testosterone replacement.
Well, I know Mark Peterson was probably the most recent guy to test for high testosterone levels, but my kind of concern, I guess you could say, is how come all these MMA fighters immediately are making the news for whenever they haven't, they get an exemption, but boxers obviously have to be doing it. If the boxing commissions are regulating it for the MMA, or the athletic commissions, so boxers obviously have to be doing it. You know, because it's available to them. And you see a lot of these boxers, you know, in their old age, you know, past 40, 45, some of them still fighting. So, I mean, I don't know
right.
doing it, but you would think it would help. So I just don't understand why it's not in the news more for these boxers who are doing it. Obviously, there's got to be somebody out there doing it. And they just don't make waves for some reason. I guess it's just not that popular.
Well, maybe it gets back to would testosterone replacement or steroids be more effective in an MMA context than boxing? I'm not saying I have the answer to that. That's an open question.
Maybe. And the other stigma here is, you know, we talked about this a few weeks ago with Belfort, where he's having some issues here about where he can fight because of, you know, not every commission is approving these exemptions. And they always, actually, in some places, they're considering your history. Belfort has tested positive for steroids before, so their automatic conclusion is going to be, well, he needs it because he's damaged his body from doing steroids, so we're not going to give it to him. So it's just kind of interesting that all the different dynamics of this, I guess you could call it an epidemic for the people that aren't approved for it, but you know, for some of these people that do need it, Belfort makes the point that it really is a serious condition. You know, whether you know, it comes naturally that you get to a certain age and you have these issues, or it's because you abused your body back in the day. And these guys really come up with a point in that everything rides on how well they do in a fight, how exciting it is. So it kind of makes people lean towards using this type of stuff to get an advantage or just to compete at a higher level, or the highest level possible. Anyway, guy who probably could have used testosterone use exemptions rather than bowing out of his comeback attempt, this made the news recently, James Age, once known as the Mighty Quinn, and who's a hard left hook, propelled him from the elite of Pittsburgh to the world championship, is in the news. He's been pegged as the button-down bandit. It was in a jailhouse interview on Tuesday, a day after he was arrested on suspicion of robbing 8 East Bay banks in Virginia. And it says, he says, it's something I got to fight. I'll have my day in court. And they arrested him Monday after a nearly 3-month investigation into bank robberies in Alameda, Contra Costa. According to the FBI, Page was a suspect in the robbery of these banks, and they dubbed him the button-down bandit because he wore long-sleeve collared shirts to all the heists. And this article says, in jail on Tuesday, he wore yellow jail garb and sandals. But he was actually in jail before, including 10 months in San Quentin in late 1996 and 1997, after he was convicted of a theft from a Concord athletic club. He was stripped of his title after he failed to appear at a mandatory fight in November 2000. And in December 2001, he was arrested in the robbery of another bank in Atlanta and later sentenced to 11 years in federal prison. And right after his release in 2012, he attempted a comeback and lost his first comeback fight in November 2012. And at that time, he said he had put his life of crime behind him. He said, I got my head right to stay on the right path to get back to the championship of the world. And Linda Hudson, who managed Page in the early days, called his arrest a shame. He had a lot of talent, Hudson said. You just hate to see that happen. There was a really good side to him. He just ran into the wrong people and went the wrong direction. And his bail is set at $395,000. So unless he stashed a lot of that money away, he's probably not getting down anytime soon.
Boy, it sounds like he was a coast-to-coast crime wave. You say California, Atlanta, now Virginia. Well, at least he's got all bases covered, huh? Jeez,
right.
I hate to hear that.
And he rose to prominence in the 90s, attracting attention from promoter Don King, and he knocked out Russian Andrei Kasparyov in 2 rounds in Paris to win the WBA title. So, talk about wasted talent. It's kind of the opposite of that Dewey Bazella story, the guy who was in jail for all those years for a crime he didn't commit, and then came out and made his comeback and won on a Bernard Hopkins undercard. He was in jail for the right reasons, came out and lost. What can you do? So
I remember reading one a couple years ago, in the last 10 years, And I was in a Ring magazine somewhere, and they were talking about this, one fighter that he was in prison, and, in the whole time he was always campaigning for his innocence. So I kind of like Jimmy Bazella, but you could tell, like, this guy was a little bit more shady. And they said, he finally gets out, and he's going to have his fight. But they said the whole promotion was just, there was just something really fishy about it. Unlike, the thing with Louis Vizella, because he fought on the Bernard Hopkins, Golden Boy card, which, was, up and up. And they said, this fight, this guy who's supposed to be all good formed and he's supposed to be such a good guy now, he basically tried to cheap shot his opponent at the introductions, the pre-fight introductions. And then they said, something happened in the ring, and they said, you looked in this guy's face, and you could just literally see, you could tell the guy was just an evil dude. I can't remember his name. I wish, and if I could find that Ring magazine, I would tell you. But they said it was just, it was one where a guy tried to play the sympathetic role, and he really wasn't.
Well, there was another story within the last couple of years, again, where a fighter got busted for bank robberies because they got his DNA off the cotton swab from a bloody nose in one of his boxing matches.
I remember that. I heard about that one.
And he was an actor fighter and doing all right. So another big surprise. Anyway, getting back to MMA here for a minute. We got Bellator making some big moves. We're going to be coming up on their reality series, and they're going to be doing some fights on Wednesday nights instead of Thursdays. But in the fall, they're going to be moving to Fridays. I don't know what the Friday night fight schedule is like on ESPN when they take their break, but if it's at the same time, I guess they're going to have some MMA competition in the fall because they're going to run their second season on Spike in the 9 to 11 time slot starting on September 13th.
And
that's moving from Thursday to avoid the NFL games on the NFL network, according to Spike TV. Which makes sense, not to avoid the popularity of our show.
okay, that's good.
Anyway,
also, Tony, I went out and got the version of Ring Magazine, the only one that was at my outlet, and so you make sure you bring the one with your dad there. But there's something here, just real brief, I'd like to, I know we've discussed this before, but in their section of good, bad, and worse, I want to read this to you guys and kick this around a bit. In the bad, the final round of the Saul Canelo Alvarez Austin Trout fight in San Antonio should have been a thrilling conclusion to what appeared to be a close fight. Instead, the WBC's loathsome open scoring policy, in which the scoring is revealed to the corners after rounds 4 and 8, destroyed any potential drama. Thus, Alvarez knew he would win the fight if he stayed out of harm's way. And TV viewers were deprived of one of boxing's most compelling moments, learning who won the fight when the announcement is made, because commentators spilled the beans. Texas must learn to say no to WBC President Jose Suleiman. It hurts the sport. Now, I know we've talked about this before, this open scoring. And if I remember right, I think you guys kind of took a dim view of it. You sort of like it without that. And my question is, other sports have that. I mean, even everything from, everything from golf to boxing, golf to baseball. And the whole implication of that, what I just read, was a lot of the drama was taken away. But don't you want your guy to know, let's assume that we have to go for a knockout. I mean, you think you can adjust the strategy, like if you're really behind in a basketball game. Okay, in other words, what do you guys see as the difference between boxing and these other sports?
Well, I actually read that section. That's one of my favorite sections of Ring Magazine, the good, bad, and worse. And I remember watching that fight live, the Alvarez Trout fight, and to be honest, and I was talking about this the other day, I'm still not convinced Alvarez won that fight. Trout put on a very good boxing clinic. He did get knocked down in the seventh round from a good straight right hand early. But there were sections in there where I thought he was really taking it to Canelo. And then they're saying, like, with the open scoring, like, oh, my God, it's like, you know, after so many rounds, we have Alvarez up, like, the judges have him up, like 8 rounds to nothing. I'm like, you know, are you kidding me? You know, I was, you know, something has to be fixed. I don't know if that is the right solution. But, no, I mean, I see what you're talking about, like an NFL team. Put it down 14 to nothing, 21 to nothing, but the first quarter, you know, they're going to go on a, you know, high-paced offense. They're, you know, really going to try to, you know, pick up the tempo. They're going to pass more than run.
Right.
They're going to, you know, use no tool. They're going to do things like that. Where defense is going to try to go into more of a prevent defense to limit the big plays, defend against the pass. Obviously, with hockey, you know, you're behind, you know, you're pulling the goalie, things like that. Yeah, there is a different adjustment. Baseball, you know, I don't know how much of an adjustment you can make because the fact that it's baseball is baseball. I mean, you might want to maybe pinch run or put in a substitute, a pinch hitter. That's really all you can do there. Bring in a closer maybe if you're ahead. But with boxing. Not the fact that I don't mind as much of losing the drama of the decision. I wouldn't mind that if, you know, the decision was going to be right. In that particular fight, I think the fight could have been a lot better if, you know, the corners didn't know that Canelo was so far ahead in a fight that I didn't think he was ahead, because the corner could have been saying, yo, you got to win these last few rounds. This fight's close. Instead of saying, dude, you got this one. Stay away from them.
Mm-hmm. Well, I hear you there, but that's the issue of bad judging, which is a whole separate issue from the open scoring. Like what they used to say, that, we wouldn't dare show who's winning because the fans would riot. Well, as a boxing fan, I resent the implication that the fans are just totally out of their mind, you know, that they're just going to destroy the place if they're disagreeing with it. I don't buy that. But, I mean, my whole thing is if I have anything to do with this and my guy is losing and we know we have to change strategy, I'd rather know than think it's a close fight. I mean, you always want your guy going out all out as best you can. But you can, as you both know, you can make adjustments. And I don't know. I mean, it's – I'm just imagining if there were a scoreboard, see how the fans would react with that.
Right.
That's the other side of it, too. Like, you know, what happens if you got a hometown guy losing a fight and they come out in the fourth round with the scoring and everybody boos, you know? Is that going to make the judges have a little change of heart and start scoring it the other way because they're afraid of the boos or the crowd?
All right. Yes. That's a whole other dimension now, too. And you may have, it really went a long way to answering my question here, because when it comes to other sports, it's not as subjective, perhaps, even though we all know the judges could do better. But you make a good point, because in baseball, you get a run or you don't. In football, you get a first down or you don't. But here, that's awful interesting, because could the judges really be swayed by that? They are human beings.
And on top of that, they have only done it in the WBC so far, which is one organization, and even then, they only did it in select fights. To really get a handle on how well or it would fit with boxing, I would think you'd have to do it on a grand scale before you figure it out. If you see fights here and there, you know, if you don't have people that are really evenly matched, it might not really show how it's going to work, you know, on a mass scale. So if you did it, like, as an experiment, like, say, every fight across the world on some weekend going to be open scoring, I think you would find out a lot more than if you could do it on these hand-picked fights. Because I remember when it first came out, and they picked a world heavyweight title fight with that it's a politician now over there in Russia, I think.
What's up?
Value fighter anyway. He's a huge beast, you know. So he was kicking the guy's ass, and they did the open scoring, and it just turned out to be a dud right off the bat because nobody saw the benefit of it in the blowout. You know, so you'd really have to have it in a lot of evenly matched fights and see how that panned out. But nine times out of ten, it's going to be a skills thing anyway. One guy is better than the other. And that's just, it goes back to the judging problem if they don't get it right. It's too subjective. So that's where I think, like I said before, that, you know, there's got to be some kind of punch count numbers that get to the judges so that it gives them a more hard, concrete way to say what's round. Even though we had our former guest on, 50 Cent's lawyer there, tell us that those numbers can be swayed and can be screwed up too. So it's not really a concrete way to fix the judging issue. Anyway, it's a good argument. We should have had that on TNT.
Yeah, right.
Anyway, getting back to Friday nights with Bellator, I did want to mention, of course, we've talked about the Ultimate Fighter in 2012 tried Friday nights, and they had record low numbers. Then they moved to Tuesdays, where they had a significant increase in followers. But the other thing is kind of interesting. Spike had a previous history when it ran UFC and TNA Wrestling together on Thursdays years back, and they found out that football hurt the UFC numbers more than the wrestling. So now the Ultimate Fighter moved to Wednesdays while wrestling on Spike. Now it's actually also featuring Bellator fighter Rampage Jackson as a regular character, is still remaining on Thursdays against the NFL in the fall. So we'll see how that goes. But Fightmaster, the reality show, is going to be starting on June 19th, and that's going to be on Wednesdays. But it's going to be it's going to end before the UFC starts its major Wednesday push with live shows on August 28th and September 4th. And there's going to be a special live event on Saturday, September 7th, the night that the UFC has an event, which will be the Fightmaster final. Going to be a live show that kicks off the fall season before the move to Friday. And MMA has a pretty interesting backer out there in New York City. Shaquille O'Neal came out and defended the UFC's push to get MMA into New York. Doesn't look like it's going to happen either way, but it's just very interesting politics behind this. And it's not being challenged for the reasons that you think. It used to be there was one politician out there, Bob Riley, I think, who was outspoken in saying that, you know, it's an unsafe sport and it's brutal. And now it's all because of a scandal. It seems like it's not going to happen. And also, I think it has a lot to do with the lobbying by the Unite Here Union, which is the parent company for the Culinary Union out in Vegas. And if you know that story, they're in a big beef with the Fatitas over unionization of station casinos. So they set up a website called Unfit for Children, and it's a play on the UFC initials, obviously. But their point is that, you know, some of the UFC fighters have some pretty bad behavior. They've said some pretty controversial things in interviews. There's one fighter that got thrown out of the UFC for making a comment about a rape fan. And Quentin Jackson actually just left the UFC, got in trouble for putting out a YouTube parody of where he's showing how to rape women. It was supposed to be meant to be funny. It's obviously not a funny subject for most people.
As opposed to the NBA, where we'd ever have stuff like that happen in the NBA or the NFL, do we? Give me a break.
Right. Yeah.
Jeez. Yeah, and my question is, how could this Culinary Association be so powerful in just one state and so pathetically weak in the other 49? I wonder what the answer is to that.
Yeah, my concern with them, I mean, I actually met with people from the union because they were looking at my Zion stuff at one point. When I was out in Vegas, they actually requested to have a couple of sit-downs with me, and they seemed to be kind of doing all this work that would make more sense if they were trying to start a fighter union. rather than trying to get to Station Casinos and the Fertitas. So it was really puzzling because, you know, it doesn't mm-hmm. seem like that's really their intent, but they're making all these decisions and they're behaving in a way that it seems like that would be the only explanation for them doing that, that they're going to do a fighters union at some point. But it's like an empty threat, or not like an empty threat, but that's just like a, there's no purpose to it except to be negative against the Fertitas and Station Casinos. And as much as I don't like their tactics, and I agree with some of their feelings about the Fertitas, I don't see how dragging the MMA situation into it and the UFC is going to help them. And the only state that they can get it done in, they throw the wrench in everything, it seems to be New York, because you have a lot of women's groups there. They can pull the heartstrings off. You have Dana White saying stuff about gay people that they put out there and exploited. It's just, and there was already some resistance there in New York, so they were able to capitalize on that too.
Yeah, so it has an adverse effect on all MMA fans in New York, and that's great publicity for them. Hmm.
Yeah, and it doesn't help them unionize to get people pissed off.
No.
And it comes down to actually not just unionization, but the way they want the vote to go. It's not just a blind vote, which is what I think Station Casinos might actually agree to have. They want to have like a union representative there at the vote to count votes and to kind of intimidate people, sort of. So, you know, in some ways, I kind of think that they're being a little pigeons about it. You know, just if you're going to get an opportunity to have a vote, have a vote. Don't just sit there and, you know, argue about how the vote is going to go and try to set it up so it happens your way. So the whole thing stinks to high heaven. But what's even weirder is that it all comes down to a sexual harassment issue on the assembly, the New York State Assembly, because there was an aide to the Speaker of the Assembly, who's in support of MMA, and he was busted for a couple complaints of sexual harassment, and the Speaker, Sheldon Silver, agreed to pay a certain amount of money to two accusers and try to kind of cover it up. Now the women's groups are already on his back about that. And so they're kind of using the same tactics as the union's using against the Fertitas with MMA, coming out and trying to kill this MMA bill. But the ironic thing is, all it has to do is get to the floor for a vote. And the deadline is June 20th. And if it does get to a floor for a vote, it will probably get voted on. But apparently this whole scandal has made a bunch of the senators and congressmen over there in New York sign this big letter where they're not going to approve MMA all of a sudden because of these women's groups pressuring them, and the unions obviously know some people pressuring them as well. So it's just it's mind-boggling how that much politics can get into a decision. The heck was that?
Oh, my computer.
Anyway, so we don't think it's gonna happen in New York this year, but this will probably all be washed away by next year, and they'll get it done. Another thing I mentioned last week, I think that Connecticut just legalized MMA. But I think I spoke too soon because I didn't realize, I'd seen all these articles saying that this bill passed, and I didn't realize it actually hasn't been signed by the governor. And there might be another stumbling block there where the governor might not approve it and might not sign the bill. So we've got to kind of wait on that one, supposedly. And kind of on the same subject of UFC fighter issues that the union has been trying to kind of exploit and point out. John Fitch just got back in the news. He's going to have a big fight actually Friday night on NBC Sports Network in the World Series of Fighting, his new promotion. But he fought for the UFC for over 7.5 years and battled for the welterweight title once, and had 18 total fights with a 14-3-1 record, and he made a big stink, or the UFC made a big stink when they threw him out. Called him boring, and he had the kind of feeling that they were trying to get rid of him. And apparently Dana White came out and said a bunch of mean things about him, said that they gave him $320,000 worth of bonuses. And Fitch wanted to set the record straight this week, and he publicized on a YouTube video his entire fighter pay situation. And he also made the point that it was never about money for him. It was just about their attitude towards him and the way it seemed like they didn't want him around, even when he was still on good terms with them. Supposedly good terms. He called it a hostile environment where he was not appreciated and was a clear sign of not wanting somebody around. And Dana White came out in an interview with MMA Junkie, said that his discretionary bonuses, which are not accounted for by the typical fighter salaries, released by commissioners and athletic commissions following each fight card, said that it was $302,000 in additional bonuses on top of his agreed-upon pay structure. So, of course, Dana White has to have an expletive in every comment he makes. So he called it total bullshit about his complaints of a hostile workplace. And it's another situation where Dana White just doesn't get it. You know, he hears a complaint from somebody, and he tries to twist it. Like with John Cholis, just left the UFC, retired. And his situation was about money because he's a lower-tiered fighter and just wasn't practical for him to keep fighting because of the expenses and the travel and paying for his management and his trainers to go to these fights. And he's getting paid like $8,000 a fight, so he actually was losing money for his last fight going to Brazil. And so Dana White, instead of, you know, approaching the issue of, you know, why these guys aren't getting paid enough, he says, goes out there and says, of course, everybody's got to pay taxes, and he makes it all about taxes. And here he is, you know, trying to make it about money when the guy's talking about a hostile workplace. That has nothing to do with money for most people that complain about that. It should be elementary. It should be a simple case of logic, but this guy obviously just wants to talk about what he thinks he can make us think about. By throwing money at the situation. But Fitch's video actually explained his entire career as fighter, or UFC career as fighter pay, and he broke it down. 18 fights with the UFC, he said he was paid $1,020,000. And that was show money and win money. Doesn't include the bonuses. So if you include the bonuses, that's $1,322,000. $3 million. And one of those fights was George St. Pierre, where he got $60,000 fight of the night bonus. And Eric Silva fight, he had a $70,000 bonus. So he says, it sounds like a lot of money, but let's look at this a little bit closer. Out of the 18 fights, out of that $1,020,000, I paid 20% of that to management in the gym. So if you take that number, $1,322,000, divided by 7.5 years, I was roughly making just over $176,000 a year. So you take management and gym fees off of that, taxes, equipment, all that stuff, and that's a significantly lower number. So he would have paid around $204,000 to his management and gym, and although he didn't discuss it, he would have to pay taxes, which would also be his original pay. So, it's obviously way under $100,000 a year when you come around to it for a very brutal sport. So, he makes some interesting points. And then you have situations like Cholis, like I mentioned. He went to Brazil for UFC on FX8 earlier this year, and that country took 27% for taxes off his total gross pay. And Fitch says, he wasn't complaining about the money, but when he started to break down the numbers for the pay-per-view sales gates and attendance, he thinks the promotion is keeping a lion's share of the profits. But once White revealed the bonuses, Fitch felt compelled to reveal exactly what he was making over the course of his career with the UFC. But he stands by his original point that he was never concerned about the money that he made, and that's not what his statement was about. Money was never important to me, he said. That wasn't why I fight. That wasn't the point of fighting. I wanted to be the best in the world and prove that I'm the best in the world. I don't know why money always gets brought back up with them. It's not important to me, but I thought it was important for the fans to know what the numbers actually are and to get some kind of perspective what fighters are actually getting paid. And if Dana White really wanted to be smart in response to that and talk about money, yeah, he wouldn't have just brought up what the UFC paid him. He would have also brought up, you know, why isn't he coming out with numbers about what his sponsorships were? You know, he's getting, obviously getting paid because he was a UFC fighter, different sponsorships too. So it's not like he can cry poor. He's not even trying to cry poor, but, you know, this guy continues to show that he should never have been given this authority to be in charge of this organization just because he's got a big mouth.
Yeah.
You know, just doesn't seem to have any kind of background or education that comes forward in these kind of idiotic responses to these people. And it just doesn't seem to have any effect on you know, how they treat some of these fighters. So, it is what it is, I guess, but I just wish that... could have some kind of fighters association out there or something like that to rectify some of these situations and to put more pressure on the UFC outside of these freaking union guys, you know, trying to do it with no purpose and no kind of engine behind getting anything changed. Anyway, here's a big story, no pun intended. Actually, here's a pun intended. Antonio Bigfoot Silva is going to his doctor to see if there is any possible way to make a safe drop to the promotions of light heavyweight division in the UFC. Bigfoot is not a nickname that was given to him by chance. He is a very big guy. He actually has to cut weight to make 265. But there's a real significant motivation behind this decision to see if he can get down to 205. Thiago Silva used to be a friend of his, apparently. But now they're in a little bit of a war of words, some accusations being thrown back and forth. And Thiago Silva just knocked out his opponent at this last UFC fight. It was UFC NFX 10, or Fuel, it's Fuel 10. Anyway, Thiago knocked out his opponent, Rafael Cavalcante, in the first round there, won knockout of the night in the process. But apparently he struck Bigfoot Silva in a bad way. And he says, Silva says, I used to visit his house and he did mine. I was something of a brother to him and he simply stabbed me in the back and cheated me. He said I'm upset because he left ATT, but he knows it's not because of that why I'm mad. I thought he was a coward. Many fighters perform at different weight classes. For example, Anderson Silva and Dan Henderson. I personally will attend the doctor to see if I am able to lose weight without spoiling my health. If I can do it, I will drop weight to make this fight for sure. All I want to do is just fight him because words won't make him change. He's mentally sick. We're completely different people. I'm a family guy. I respect my father, mother, wife. I treat my friends well without pulling their legs, and I don't take drugs. And apparently that's a reference to Silva's pot smoking. So the former Elite XC heavyweight champion, who just got beat by Cain Velasquez last month, has actually accused Silva of ducking the competition at heavyweight, the weight class he claims Silva should be, Thiago should be fighting.
Okay, so I'm really hearing this right. To him, Bigfoot at 205, I have this mental image of what he... that's why I'm speechless. I'm just kind of imagining what he would look like at 205. Which leg would he have to cut off? I mean, he can't be serious. With his bone structure, he would be. I'm out of words. I have no idea what to say to that.
He'd either have to start running marathons or get some.
Well, he would look horrible at 205. I mean, and like you said, he has to cut weight to get to 265 now. Oh,
yeah.
God.
I'd be really skinny. I mean, I guess technically it might be possible because he does have some fat on him. I mean, he's not very
old. No. Anyway. Can I make a sarcastically funny comment?
Sure.
maybe he can go in the DDP yoga workout regime. I mean, a friend of mine has lost like 80 pounds in, since January.
Whoa. Wow.
But granted, my friend was about almost 480 pounds when he started, so.
Well, you have to cut weight to get to 265, so he can get to 265, so that's 60 pounds he has to lose. I don't know, it could be possible, but he would look very sickly and skinny. And, you know, you look at the guy and you can almost imagine a lot of that weight is probably in his head. Kind of reminds me of the statues, the big heads. So, I don't know, it'd definitely be a real tough fight for him to cut that much weight, but... I think it could be done. I don't know if he's that serious about it or if he's just trying to do it for publicity and just trying to throw the other Silva under the bus. But it'll be interesting. A Silva versus Silva fight. In that respect. But that'll be wild to see. Anyway, another guy, another heavyweight. Statement here. Ray Sifo, the World Series of Fighting president and a former legendary kickboxer, Ray Sifo is going to be stepping out of retirement to compete on his own card. 43 years old and on the MMA Hour with Ariel Helwani, he broke the story that he's going to be competing at the upcoming World Series of Fighting 4, August 10th in Ontario, California. Sifo doesn't have an opponent yet, but he joins a lineup that already features Tyrone Spong, a lightweight fight between Tyson Griffin and Jesus Cavalcante. And there's also kind of a drought of heavyweights in the promotion. And that could be a quick way to bolster the division by getting himself in there. And they had a previous canceled bout between Rawls Hollis Gracie, I guess it's pronounced with an H, and Dave Hakaba. It was originally slated for the main card of World Series of Fighting 3 this Friday, but Gracie was forced to withdraw to the main 3. Either one of those guys could be Sifo's opponent on the next card. But he's fought professionally in boxing, kickboxing, and MMA. He hasn't been, Sifo hasn't been active since 2012 in a decision loss to former Pride Openweight champion Herko Filipovic in the kickboxing bout. As for MMA, Sifo most recently suffered a first round decision loss to Valentin Overeem in Strikeforce DOR versus Silva back in February of 2011. And, I mentioned earlier, the drug test was actually UFC 160, where the former WEC bantamweight champion Brian Bowles returned to the cage for the first time since November of 2011. And he was the only fighter from the May 25th card whose post-fight drug test came back with issues. Bowles got TKO'd by George Roop in the second round of their preliminary card bout. But he came back with a testosterone to epitestosterone ratio of more than 20 to 1. Sorry, I thought it was 17 to 1. The acceptable level in the state of Nevada is 6 to 1. So more than 20 to 1. That's a lot of testosterone. He must have been putting it on his Wheaties. It's pretty crazy. The Nevada Athletic Commission Executive Director, Keith Kaiser, provided the drug test results and stated that a complaint against Bowles would be coming shortly. Bowles was out between 2011 and 2013, tending to injuries, and the loss dropped his career record to 10-3. He will face a fine and suspension as a result of the failed test. Here's another story about South African mixed martial arts getting a boost. So MMA is widely recognized as the fastest growing sport in the world, but it still came as a shock and surprise when Supersport today announced a 3-year broadcasting deal with professional MMA promotion EFC Africa. And their live event broadcast will now be extended to feature all 5 main card bouts, aired live in prime time between 8 o'clock and 11 o'clock on Supersport's Blitz, the most widely aired channel on the Supersport bouquet. It's not really that much of an interesting story, but I thought I'd mention that. It's kind of a weird situation. You would think boxing would be popular in South Africa, but he's catching on. And, of course, we got to talk about last week's big MMA card, Fabricio Werdum beat Antonio Rodrigo Nogueira, just as Tom predicted. Werdum goes to 17-5-1. Nogueira drops to 34-8-1. It wasn't a particularly interesting fight. Didn't last very long. It was 2:41 into the second, and Werdum got kind of an awkward arm bar. They called it actually an arm lock as it happened. I'm not sure what the difference is, but it was sort of kind of an over the head arm bar instead of side to side, I guess. And it was a very sloppy fight. I don't think either guy really was out to knock the other one out the way they were fighting.
Now, what do you think the future is for Nog? It's been a lot of talk that, you know, how many times can you keep getting your arm broken, having to go to surgery? And does he really have anything else to prove? Think he should quit?
Well, I mean, he's a name, and he's getting paid probably good money just for being a name. And there's not that many guys out there in that weight division to be opponents. You know, not that he's an opponent by any stretch. I mean, he still has the capability to beat guys up. But it's like one of those guys like Forrest Griffin. If he didn't just retire, he could have stayed around forever, win or lose. And it's all in a name for some of these guys, but it's also because they have a history. And it's not just in the UFC. I mean, a lot of these guys, especially with the Pride history, their draws all over the world, not just in the United States or his own country of Brazil. So I think it would be kind of a mistake for the UFC to let him go, and they would encourage him to stick around just because of all those factors. But as far as Nogueira himself, I don't think you know, he has any thoughts even about retirement at this point. He's just you know, one of those guys that if you catch him in the right situation, he's going to lose the fight. But if you catch him on his best day, he's going to surprise all the people. I mean, it's a good competition. Just because, like, you know, a lot of these guys, just because they're not in the title picture, they end up wanting to retire because of that, because there's no hope of it. Nogueira, I mean, he just doesn't have any reasons to retire. He's getting paid probably good money to stick around, and he's got a lot of fans who are probably encouraging him to stick with it. And that's all he knows. I mean, what else is he going to do? He's not going to go and put on a suit and sit in an office at the UFC SAFA office or anything. It's not going to be a situation where they're going to do that for him. They might set him up with some kind of position in Brazil, you know, like developmental, you know, something or other down there in Brazil, UFC Brazil.
And you know, I just wonder how much his ego comes into play about refusing to tap, because, you know, if you've trained, I mean, you know when you're caught.
Yeah.
And yet, this is twice now that he, it's man, well.
Well, did
I
he
think
actually
he
have
him,
an injury from this one, though?
I'm sorry, the what?
Did he end up getting an injury in this one? I know he was holding
yes,
his arm.
Yes, yeah. Apparently, he's going to have surgery again.
Ooh.
So, I just read that earlier today. And that's where some of these questions are coming up as to, I mean, as long as he's been training in jiu-jitsu, you'd really think he would know that, I mean, if you're caught, you're caught. And there's just not much you can do about it. And as skilled as he is, I mean, I'm in awe of the guy, especially after that Bob Sapp neck slam. I'll never forget that. But I just wonder if why he won't tap if he's caught. Well, only he can answer that question. We need to get him on here. Ask him.
Someday, maybe. What type of interpreter, I think. I don't know how good his English is.
No, I think his English is passable.
Okay. Well, I'll see what we can do. Let us reach out and see if that can happen. I know he's going to have some time off here, so. Should be available. But one of those things, too, is now that you mentioned that he's going to have surgery, he obviously is going to want to stick around with the UFC because that's his health insurance. You know, granted, we've heard some complaints about how effective that insurance is. But you'd think they wouldn't want to fix him unless he's going to be still fighting for them in the future.
Mm-hmm.
So, I don't know. I see him three or four more fights. And he would have to get, like, really beaten up badly. A submission is a submission, you know. It can happen to the best of people, and it has happened to the best of fighters. But if you get pummeled and beaten up really badly, like Nick Diaz in his last few fights where he finally retired, or DJ Penn, even though he's talking about coming back when he retired, he had been really beaten up, and I think that's what it takes for a lot of these guys to admit that maybe it's time to hang it up. You hate to see that happen. You hate to have it go to that length, but, you know, submission is a different story. You can get, anybody can get caught in that, and it doesn't really show that they suck at MMA. And they're getting old, you know. But, you know, you got to wonder how many times, like you said, can he come back from that type of injury? We'll see. But I don't think he has anything to be ashamed of. He did fight... He fought a decent fight up until that point. Just didn't have enough to escape that good Brazilian jiu-jitsu of Verdun. Anyway, the rest of the card, we had Leonardo Santos beat William Macario by arm triangle choke in the second round there with just 17 seconds left in the round. And as we mentioned, Thiago Silva beat Rafael Cavalcante by knockout with... about 30 seconds left in the round there, the first round. We had Eric Silva beat Jason High by reverse triangle armbar. And we had Daniel Sarafian beat Eddie Mendez by arm triangle choke. A lot of triangles. And then we had Rony Mariano Bezerra beat Mike Wilkinson, also by a triangle choke in the first round. Rafael Assuncao beat Von Lee by armbar submission in the second round. And we had Felipe Arantes beat Godofredo Castro by knockout, punches and elbows in the first round, 3:32 mark. Ildemar Alcantara beat Leandro Silva by unanimous decision. Rodrigo Dan beat Mizuto Hirota by split decision. And let's see what else we got here. Rodrigo Dan, I already said that one. Split decision. Kyle Magalhaes beat Carlos Vemola by rear naked choke in the second round. And Antonio Braga Neto beat Anthony Smith by knee bar submission. And I was wondering as I was watching this card why they didn't have any preliminaries on FX or anything like that. And I got my answer when I started watching it, and almost none of the fights went to decision. One fight went to decision. Or two. Yeah, two fights went to, one to a unanimous, one to a split decision. That's pretty rare. But anyway, we talked about Rampage a little bit earlier. He made his Impact Wrestling debut opposite Kurt Angle. And in a little bit of an interesting twist there, we saw another episode that was taped that same night where Rampage came to the rescue of Kurt Angle. So we don't know whether that's going to be a rivalry or a friendship team-up situation in the wrestling world there. But Rampage actually is still recovering from a knee injury, so he won't likely get into the Bellator cage until this fall. But he's definitely available for FaceTime in the Impact Wrestling scene there. So they didn't waste any time getting him out there with a big old dog chain on and everything, howling at the moon. But he got in the face of Kurt Angle, and they both mean-mugged at each other for a little while. And spoke some words to each other about Rampage wanting to fight the best, and Angle saying he was the best. So I guess he's going to be a good fit. He seemed to be... pretty good with his acting there, even though it didn't require all that much skill to stand there and look mean, basically. We'll see how he fits in, but I think anything is better than his performance on the A-Team, I would think. I don't know if he was that good in that movie. You know, they play it all the time now on FX. But the contract there with him is pretty interesting because he's going to have his own reality show. He's talked a little bit about that, saying that he's not going to let it be scripted like a lot of these shows out there, even though he's going to be doing stuff while they're filming that he wouldn't normally do. He's not going to let them decide exactly what he does and when. He's going to be trying to be more natural in this one, so we'll see how that goes. But it's going to be kind of like King Mo's reality documentary, more than a reality show. But King Mo, when he came over to do the UFC, or the Bellator and TNA contract, he had a show that actually went through how he did the switches from wrestling camp to MMA training camp. And I thought that was pretty interesting. Some of it was a little scripted when he was, you know, having a little bit of a rivalry with some of the wrestlers in the camp. But for the most part, it was pretty real and pretty interesting, seeing how that dynamic works out. And they haven't ruled out a fight between the two of them either. So that could be on the future horizon there for those two. But it's interesting because, you know, we talked about how Bellator is this big, huge parent company. Viacom is the ownership there. And, you know, they should be paying these guys a lot better than the UFC is, because they don't have that much of a backing group. I mean, they've got billionaires in charge as majority owners, and they got the guys in Abu Dhabi who own Ferrari with ownership positions, but I think Viacom is much bigger, and they should be able to pay a lot more for some of these guys. But instead of doing that, they're giving them what the UFC doesn't have, which is movie connections, television production situations like this with and the wrestling connections. So it gives them a lot better personality to work with, especially with whenever these guys retire, they're going to have way more exposure to the fan bases of all these different TV shows, the wrestling and the MMA, to you know, go sign autographs for and do those circuits and you know, get all kinds of appearance fees and stuff like that. So I think it'll work out well for Rampage. I don't know how many years he has left, but it's definitely interesting. We'll see if this becomes a trend for Bellator. This is already the second guy they've done this for. So it's an attractive thing for anybody leaving the UFC to come in and do something like that. We'll see if it lasts. Anyway, another story. I emailed you guys this last week is Big Daddy Bo, former guest on our show, is going to be taking up the Muay Thai career here. Maybe not a career, but he's definitely going to have at least one fight here in Bangkok. He's over 300 pounds now, or around 300 pounds. So he's obviously going to still be fighting at heavyweight. He's 45 years old. So on our interview with him, he's got some slurred speech, but he's adamant that he's had tests that show that he doesn't have any brain injuries. I don't know how that happens, but anyway, he said...
I'm worried about the guy. I remember watching him coming up in his career after the 88 Olympics. At the time, he was with Eddie Futch. You know, and my memory serves me correct, I believe they had a blowing out during the second Holyfield fight because it just posed pretty much refusal to, condition himself. And I remember Futch getting really frustrated. After he lost that fight to Holyfield, I went to actually see him fight live in his next fight down in Atlantic City against Buster Mathis Jr., who would later go on to fight Mike Tyson. And Buster Mathis Jr., who was a light-fisted, he wasn't a big puncher. He was one of those spoiler-type fighters who could just make you look bad. And he was making Bo look bad for about three rounds. And then Bo finally knocked him down. And then he clocked him when he was on his knees and knocked him out. And they ruled that they didn't disqualify him. But obviously, because originally they counted Mathis out. And Larry Hazard Jr. got right in the ring and said, no way. He hit the guy when the guy was on his knees about 2 seconds after the guy went to his knees. And it ended up being a disqualification. And then his career I'm trying to think of the proper wording for it. And I think maybe like absurd would be a good definition. And had the third fight with Holyfield that he won. and that was good. Then he had the two fights with Galata, and he took a lot of punishment. You know, he looked bad in those fights. He took a lot of punishment, especially that second fight, and it was actually scary when they were talking to him afterwards. And then he had the stint when he tried to go in the Marine Corps, and he dropped out after 3 days. He had, you know, when he kidnapped his wife and his kids. You know, we're talking about a guy that, you know, it was, there's something definitely is not right. And then I remember even when he mounted a boxing comeback back around 2004, 2005, and even his fights there, I remember he was fighting a guy, Billy Zumbrum, who was a club fighter at best. And he actually, and that was around 280 pounds there, 280, almost 300 pounds. And I remember Zumbrum at a couple points had him on the ropes and was hitting him with some solid punches. And I remember watching him and almost cringing because I don't think the guy should be getting hit with, you know, like that anymore. You know, and then like, so we talked to him, and I remember telling people about the interview, and I said, you know, we talked to a guy like Roy Jones who suffered a couple serious knockouts, who sharp as a tack. You know, Roy was... retire, but at the same time, he was a very sharp guest, very on point with everything.
Well, we got stories about him later on, too.
Yeah, and I remember there were points, Rich, when he was going to say something, and you and I would come in, and he would say something and start chuckling, and we would just chuckle, too, even though we had no idea what he said.
Yeah, he was a translator. It's like he does in Thailand. But anyway, he's claiming that Thai boxing has brought him back to life. He says he's been sitting at home bored to death, something like that. He's trying to figure out what to do. And the story also mentions that must have been exactly what he was doing because he blew up over 400 pounds at one point. So he really is crediting this change in direction for getting him back to life, basically, and to living. But he also... said that he had too much fun when he was in the midst of his boxing career. He said it wasn't a job, it was an adventure for him.
Well, we'll see how he likes some of those leg roundhouse kicks. That'll bring him back to life. Nothing like pain to remind you you're alive, huh? So, we'll see how he deals with it.
All right, we're back. I don't know what happened there. I don't know where I left off either, but I think it was probably before I read that last line anyway. But as I was saying, the funniest line in this whole story is him answering the question, why Muay Thai appeals to him. He says, I have 12 sisters and brothers, and this is how we used to fight. We just knew it was a sport. So, apparently he's... he's going to give it a shot. We'll see if it becomes a long-term thing for him. His wife says he was a little worried about it, but I guess he's convinced he can do it. So we'll see how it goes. But he's 6'5" and 300 pounds. So I imagine a lot of these guys from Thailand, that's going to be a pretty big dude. And that doesn't say much about his opponent at all in here. So I don't know what he's dealing with as far as record-wise. So I would imagine because he's such a popular figure worldwide, they're not going to put him against a superior fighter. I would think that, oh, here it is. Russian 30-year-old Russian fighter Levin Golovin is his opponent. Fighting on June 14th. So I don't know how that's going to work out. I would think that he might have a better shot to win if you put him in against a guy with little to no experience in Muay Thai. And then his boxing experience will pay dividends. But we'll see, as always. And as I said, there's another Roy Jones Jr. story in the news here. We've got an old story. It's coming back, actually. Anderson Silva wants Roy Jones Jr. And Roy Jones Jr. has said he's accepting Anderson Silva's challenge to a boxing match. So at the same time, the clock is ticking. And they spoke, TMZ actually spoke to the 44-year-old former boxing champion LA this week, who said he heard Silva loud and clear when Anderson told the New York Post about his dream to fight a great champion like Jones. And Silva's 38, Jones is 44. Silva's currently under contract with the UFC, but he suggested that Dana White should strike a deal to make the fight happen. And as we know from past criticism of Dana White and the UFC, they don't allow any kind of cross-promotional things. They don't allow these guys to do outside sports of any kind. And the only time they've ever allowed that is when they have the Strikeforce situation going on. They took over the Strikeforce contracts, but those contracts were still in place where they could compete in other circuits and stuff like that, but you didn't really see these guys going over to boxing or anything from MMA. And that's what we're talking about here. Now, obviously, UFC 162 on July 6th is going to feature a fight between Silva and Chris Weidman. Roy said he's concerned about his age. So if it's going to happen, it's going to happen ASAP. And Jones suggested the two should get in the ring right after that fight on July 6th. If it's going to happen at all. And we haven't really seen this. We've seen a lot of these boxers coming over to MMA here and there. Prove the point. You know, that's one major situation where that happened. There was no point proof at all. With James Toney choked out by Randy Couture. So, I don't know if this is going to prove anything. Obviously, Silva's a little bit younger, 6 years younger than Roy Jones Jr. I would think it was more when they first started talking about this, but an intriguing prospect at the same time. It just doesn't seem like it's worth talking too much about because I think Dana White will basically strike it down. Silva's under a pretty long contract here with the UFC, like a 7 or 8 night contract he's got. So, I doubt that they'll let him go pursue a boxing match, even if it's a 3-round exhibition or something. I don't think they'll let him do it. But on top of the fact that Silva could get hurt, is the whole idea of, you know, opening the floodgates. I don't think they want to do that. So, all these guys in the UFC say, well, he did it, so I should be able to do it. And that's the last news story I have, per se. We do have a big MMA event coming up this weekend, big UFC fight, UFC 161. So let's go over that, and then I guess Tony can tell us what we got coming up for boxing matches. But leading this fight card, well, you guys are going to be at the fights, King of Prussia, the casino. You've got a fight here in Winnipeg, Manitoba, Canada. UFC 161. Rashad Evans is going to be in the main event against Ian Henderson. And both guys are coming off losses. Rashad actually has back-to-back losses he's coming off. And Henderson just lost to Mashiya. They got canceled with John Jones. So, both guys have a little bit to prove. I don't know if either one's going to get thrown out if they lost. They lose, but Rashad, I think, has got the most to prove back-to-back losses. His total record is 17-3-1. Henderson has a lot more experience. He's got 29 wins, 9 losses, and no ties. No draws there, but I don't know. I kind of like Rashad Evans in this one, but I think Dan Henderson could shock the world there with one punch if it comes down to that. But Evans is just he's got a lot more head and ball movement. He's a lot more tactical now that he's been knocked out before, and I think he's going to have the better strategy going into this one. And
the fight that I keep going back to is Rashad and Rampage. and I think that'll be Rashad's tactics here, and I see him winning a rather slow decision.
Yeah,
you know, I mean, as you said, Henderson can always catch him with one punch. Henderson's got that big eraser, that big right hand. But Rashad just seems to, he's got that movement. He's just, I just see him, and if worse comes to worse, I'll go to the ground, and I think Dan's wrestling may be a little better, but not much. I think Rashad will do enough just to kind of stall it out, and I'm not anticipating a real barn burner.
But as far as you know, who's going to be in the title picture with a win, I think Dan Henderson wins. He's going to be closer to a title shot than Rashad Evans. So that might put a little bit more fire under him. But we'll see. I mean, obviously it's going to be a complete fight. I don't think it's going to end in the first round. Might see a full decision here. Based on the way these guys both fight, if Henderson wins, like you said, it's probably going to be a lot of wrestling involved. And if Evans wins, it's going to be keeping away and throwing pot chops and jabs and leg kicks. So who knows what's actually going to happen? Well, Tom knows because he's psychic. I like
Stand
Rashad.
By what I said. Yeah, Rashad by not too exciting of a decision.
And we have the heavyweights in the co-main event, Pat Barry versus Sean Jordan. Pat's got an 8-5 record going in. Jordan's got a 14-4 record. Pat has, I think, a little bit more UFC experience. But I always laugh when I see Pat Barry's name because I always think of the fight with Mirko Croker up there where he just kept hugging him. And he was winning the fight and then ended up, because he had so much respect for this guy, he ended up with a broken foot and a mashed up face. He let Croker get back in the fight. So hopefully he doesn't have that much reverence for Sean Jordan and see a better performance out of him here. And then we have a women's fight in the sporting fight here for the main event. And we have Alexis Davis, who's 13-5, fighting Rosie Sexton, who's 13-2. And I really don't know a lot about either woman here. But as we all know from watching women's MMA, especially women's MMA in the UFC, these ladies definitely come in a little bit of a chip on their shoulders, and they seem to fight for all of womankind rather than just themselves. So I think that this could rival for fight of the night here if it's a great competitive match. And there's a couple Strikeforce vets fighting in the fight on the card. Kate Shields, 27-6-1, fighting Tyron Woodley, who's 11-1. Had a pretty rough, I know Jake had a pretty rough UFC debut, getting smacked around the cage by George St. Pierre. So he's going to have to get back on the right foot to beat Tyron Woodley. He's only got one loss, but this is kind of more on par for him fighting a Strikeforce guy than trying to go right in after his UFC guys. So we'll see. And Sam Hansen-Stone Stout, 19-8-1, fighting James Krause, who's 19-4. That seems like a pretty easily matched fight. Then we got Tom's buddy, Stipe Miocic, 9-1, fighting everyone else's buddy, Roy Nelson, the Burger King's buddy.
Yeah, well...
This is a big one, because... Of course, he's only got one loss, and he's obviously trying to, make a statement that he's hanging with the best. Nelson's got a little more experience here, but Nelson's also facing this being his last fight on his UFC contract, and he's made a lot of comments, negative comments about the way the brass feels about him in the UFC. How they don't really want him around, but he's kind of stuck with them because he keeps winning. So this, even though he doesn't have a bunch of losses strung together here that traditionally gets the best kicked out of the UFC, this could be a situation where if he loses this one fight, he won't have him back with another contract, regardless of how popular he is with the fan base. He's got a lot to fight for here, and he could have a pretty big weight advantage over Stipe, I would think. So I guess she could tell Stipe to stick the jab.
Yeah, he just that's the kind of fight he cannot make a mistake. He just can't make a mistake. And I would say if he's still if he does make a mistake on the feet and if he's still conscious, he better get the fight to the ground, and then we'll see how his wrestling does against Royce Jiu-Jitsu. So we'll see what happens. I mean, of course, I've got to go on record with Stipe, but that does have an asterisk. My prediction has an asterisk beside it, since I'm not exactly emotionally not attached. But even though I'm a big fan of Roy, but I've got to go with my hometown guy here. So we'll see how it goes. And as I said, now it's your assignment to give us a breakdown here, because after our fights are over, I'll be checking in with you.
All right. Well, we have some encouraging news, I guess, not news, but some analysis of Roy Nelson's record would tell you that if Stipe can make it out of the first round, he has a better shot, because Nelson has won by knockout or TKO in his last three fights, and all of them ended in the first round. One of them, 2 seconds left in the first round against Matt Mitrione. Actually, you know, 3 minutes, I'm thinking of power things. It's actually 2:58 in the first round, the longest he's gone in his last three fights. And he lost to Fabricio Werdum in a decision that went 3 rounds. And before that, Frank Mir and another Junior Dos Santos in another decision. So if his fights go the distance recently, he loses. And he did beat Mirko Filipovic in a 3-round fight, but that actually ended by TKO in the 3rd round. So just, I guess, tire him out is the other strategy you could use. We'll see. But again, Stipe's coming in with a little bit less experience. I don't know what kind of an amateur career he had. Maybe you could tell us, Tom.
Not a whole lot.
And he does have a lot of knockouts. He's only got 2 wins, not by knockout, actually. 1 submission, 1 decision. He's coming off a loss to Stefan Struve in the 2nd round by TKO. But before that, he had 3 straight wins in the UFC against Joey Beltran and Philip DeFries and Shane Del Rosario in the UFC 146. And he's capable of winning by decision. He made his UFC debut back in October of 2011 with a decision against Joey Beltran there, UFC 136. So, he's capable, but doesn't have a lot of huge experience in his amateur fights. According to Sherbaugh, he's had 5 amateur fights, all wins by TKO. TKO punches, and all of them in the first round. So I guess he's had a pretty fast rise to fame there. And only 1 decision in his whole career. That's pretty interesting, amateur and professional. So he's capable, but I don't think anybody would knock him if he does end up losing. He's a pretty tough guy to pick on. You've only had 10 professional fights, and you're going up against a guy with 26 fights.
Yeah, there's always that question. Is he being rushed into this a little too quick? Because, you know, he kind of hoped that he'd have a little softer fight after his first pro loss, but still comes down to this. You fight when the opportunity's there and go from there.
Okay. Then we have Ryan Jumel, 17-2, fighting Igor Pokrzyk, 25-9. Another experience factor there for Igor over Jumel. We'll see how that one goes. I got Eve Jibling, 18-8, fighting Dustin Pig, 11-7. Kenny Robertson, 12-2, fighting Sean Pearson, 13-6. And John McGuire, 18-5, fighting Mitch Clark, who's 9-2. And finally, Roland DeLorme, 8-1, fighting Edwin Figueroa. And hopefully we've left plenty enough time to preview what kind of boxing we got this weekend.
Well, I got 9 minutes. Let me rock and roll here. We got an interesting card up in Bethlehem, PA, which is about 35 to 40 minutes north of where I live, close to Allentown.
Is there a Jesus fight on that card?
What?
Is there a Jesus fight on that card?
No, there's not. No, I don't see one. I mean, do you want there to be?
Well, it's Bethlehem, it ought to be, right?
What do you think of that? great. You got me off my game. But in the main event, we got Sergey Kovalev, a very impressive light heavyweight. He's 20-0, 18 knockouts. In his last fight, he destroyed from a world title challenger, Gabriel Castillo, in 3 rounds. He's stepping up against the once beaten Cornelius White, who's 21-1, 16 knockouts. His only loss was a first round TKO about 2.5 years ago to Don George in Atlantic City. Since then, he had a fight with a very tough fighter from Philadelphia, Dear Smith. Won a split decision there. Most of his last offerings have gone a distance, so maybe it's a case where he was matched easy early in his career. I'm looking at some of the records: 8-22, 22-42, 7-28, 0-4. So it looks like he had some easy pickings, and then when he stepped up in class, he got knocked out by Don George, and then his last, you know, his last knockout was against a fighter that was 9-40. So it's possible, very likelihood that he's just been fighting softer opposition, and he's going to run into a buzzsaw on Sergey Kovalev. Also, we have two guys from local ties on the card. One of them is a very impressive heavyweight, Brian Bye Bye Chang, who I got to cover. He's really moving up the heavyweight ladder. 16-0, 8 knockouts, but he's got more impressive punching power than that. In his last fight back in December, knocked out Gui Toro with an uppercut in 5 rounds. He's fighting a gentleman by the name of Andre Fedosov. Don't know much about him. He's 24-2, 19 knockouts. His only loss was a split decision loss about 3 years ago to Lance Mount Griffey Whitaker. Your typical guys, your Darnell Wilsons, your Galen Browns, your Lyle Butlers. So I think in this type of fight, you're going to have to look for a guy like Brian Jennings to lower the boom, probably in the mid-rounds. He's going to box him early and then unleash that right hand, which, has pretty good power in it. And then we also have Ronald Cruz, good fighter, literally lives a couple blocks from the arena. He's coming off his first loss back in September, Antoine Smith. He's 17-1, 12 knockouts. He's fighting Ray Nahr, who I've gotten to see before. Ray is coming off his last fight. Hasn't fought in 2 years. His last fight was a third-round stoppage to Mike Alvarado. Another loss was back in October, but was also a one-round knockout loss. So, you got a fighter 25-2, 21 knockouts. His two losses have been my knockout. So he's the guy that either goes out swinging or he takes you out. So pick a card on NBC right there. And let's take a look, see what we got for Saturday night. Obviously, I want to preview the card quickly. The time that I'll be attending in the team of Prussia, PA. The main event is going to be 10 rounds. They lost 6 rounds in March. Harry Joe Yorgi and Felice Kennedy. Harry's last fight was the 6-round split decision over Julius. Harry's now 26-2, 12 knockouts. Not a big puncher, but he's a high action rate fighter. Julius Kennedy fought once since that fight to Harry Yorgi and got stopped in 5 rounds to DiCarlo Perez, who I've seen before. He's now 7-5, 3 knockouts. That was his only stoppage loss. What I noticed in the first fight was Kennedy put a lot of pressure on early. He was a very physical guy. But he wore down in the 5th and 6th round, and he had him hurt pretty good. So if he could survive that early storm and not get caught into a slugfest early, it's likely he'll be able to take over after round 5 and then possibly even stop him. I also want to tell Tom, bring your sunglasses. Because if you remember my report last time, when Kevin Farmer fought, he had to wear sunglasses in the ring because his sequins were so bright, literally shining the glare off the lights.
Okay, I'll remember that.
He's a very flashy fighter.
Getting back. Still there, right, Tom?
I'm here.
Okay, you back?
Yes, you are back.
Okay. I'll say that Kevin Palmer, a very flashy fighter. He's like the poor man's Adrian Broner. 10-4, one draw. He has one knockout, so you're not going to see him really, go for the power punches there. He's fighting a tough Puerto Rican kid by the name of Victor Vasquez, who I've had the privilege of seeing on a number of occasions. And Victor's going to make him fight. Victor's 16-7 with seven knockouts. So, he's not going to be walking the park for Tevin Farmer. And then, we have some other fights we're having in the card out. Jeremy Stoffer versus Kamara Paisley is on the card. Kamara is a very good friend of mine. That should be an interesting fight. Todd on Thankmay, very good prospect coming up out of Philadelphia. Travis the Animal Thompson, he's a club fighter at best, but he always is good for a good action fight. He earned his nickname, the Animal. And then just briefly we'll talk about what we're going to have in Dallas, Texas. A very interesting fight. This is going to be on HBO, I believe, either HBO or Showtime. I know it's going to be televised. Mikey Garcia, coming off his big win over Orlando Salido, is fighting Juan Manuel Lopez. Garcia, 31-0, 26 knockouts. Lopez, 33-2, 30 knockouts. So expect some fireworks there. Somebody's likely not going to see the final bell. And then in the co-feature, we got Vaines Martirosian, Ryan Davis, Terrence Crawford, and Alejandro Sanabria. Good weekend of fight. Enjoy them.
All right. Well, as always, the ring name comes through. And looking forward to hearing your guys' experience on the fights this weekend. I wish I could be there. But, probably cost me $500 just to get there. So, I had to bow out there, but when I get my lawsuit money, we'll do something. We'll get together.
Sounds like a plan. There's going to be many more of them, and as I always say, enjoy the fights. I know we're going to be. That's for sure.
That's absolutely right. Ty, I'm going to send you an email tomorrow morning with just how I have, like what time I'm going to get there and where I'm going to be and stuff, so that way we're all on the same page.
Then I'll have your phone number, so I'll call with my room number too. So we'll get all straightened out.
All right.
Look forward to it.
All right.
Thanks, everybody. Till next week. Adios.
All right.
Enjoy the fights and Bruins game this Saturday.